back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined by my good buddy, Mr. Gene Hendricks. Hey, Gene.
Hail and well met.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, Paul, and, you know, especially when we're covering books like this, you know, it's not the, I mean, it's not like we're covering, oh, I don't know, the Black Hole, for example.
But that, by the time this airs, that's going to be a way in the distant memory callback for everyone. But, you know, just so I hope everybody's enjoying listening to this as much as Gene and I are recording this, because we've already started to talk about, okay, after today, we're only going to have one issue of this series left. And we are enjoying it enough that we're saying, okay, what are we going to cover after this is done? We're not going to just, you know, wipe our hands and walk away. We want to do some more. So again, I hope you guys are enjoying listening as much as we're enjoying doing this. So today we are covering issues 10 and 11 of the 12-issue miniseries Camelot 3000. And we might as well jump right into it. Gene, you have issue 10.
All right. So issue number 10 has a cover date of March 1984. That's 40 years ago, Paul.
Oh, my God. That makes me feel so old.
It was on sale on January 29th of 1983. Stories by Mike W. Barr, pencils Brian J. Bolland, inks by Terry Austin, letters by John Costanza, colors Tatiana Wood, and your editor is Len Wein. On the cover, we have Arthur, Gawain, Galahad, and Tristan in the middle of a huge firefight. We open on the armed and fenced Capitol building with the title of Prelude to War. Inside, President Marx is speaking to Chairperson Feng, Premier Seryov, or however you pronounce that Russian name, Seryov, and the Supreme Rachma over Zoom. They're upset that Arthur has disappeared and the aliens are still a menace. The president thinks that Matthew isn't doing a good enough job at the UN, which is when the signal cuts out and a mysterious person shocks Marx by coming in. In Moscow, Beijing, and Rachmaburg, it must be a little bitty place, the other three world leaders are assassinated. The Russian by an alien, Feng is murdered by Morgan's pet, and Rachma by Morgan herself. Back in D.C., we see that Marx is dealing with Mordred, now in a set of golden armor, shades of Excalibur. Marx shoots him twice in the chest, once in the neck, and once in the head. Mordred falls, but immediately stands up again. His armor has incorporated the Grail into it, so Mordred heals immediately. He runs Marx through with his sword and heads back to the UN. At the UN, Mordred tells Morgan that she can have the Grail once he's through with it, and not one moment before, regardless of how weak she is. Mordred accesses something called Project Suntrap, and Morgan winces in pain. Meanwhile, in Oregon, our team from the cover, along with their Neoman allies, are trying to break into a secure building. Mordred calls the commanding general there and tells him that the intruders are the assassins of the world leaders. Breaking into the complex, Arthur commands Tristan to distract the nearby guard. Tristan isn't happy about it, but he uses his feminine wiles to get the guard's attention and then beats the snot out of him. The group successfully sneaks past, and Tristan asks why Arthur asks for such a distraction from him. Arthur explains that it was a test of loyalty. Tristan says that Morgan's sorcery is all he cares about, not her cause. Once Morgan gives him the body of a man, Tristan intends to kill her. As the Neo-Men try to open a door, a searchlight spots them. Gawain tries to get Arthur to retreat, but Arthur just takes out Excalibur and slices through the obstacle. Inside, they find a rocket. Galahad enters while the others hold off the guards. He finds the power cells have no charge, so they can't escape. The guards shoot in tear gas and everyone boards the rocket. Arthur commands Galahad to take the controls and he uses Excalibur to bring the power cells to full. The rocket launches and as they pass over England, they leave the atmosphere. And this causes Arthur to wonder if he's ever going to see his beloved island again. Galahad engages the solar sails and the knights are on their way to Planet 10. Meanwhile, back at the UN, the general is apologizing to Mordred. Mordred ends the transmission and tells Isolde that he will be gone for a few days, even though there's a major crisis going on. Morgan uses some of her waning power to teleport them to Planet 10. When she tells the aliens that Mordred is with her, several of them detach their limbs to create a litter for him to ride on. As the bodies of these aliens are left twitching, which is rather disturbing in the comic, Mordred and Morgan head to Morgan's palace, where Merlin is being held captive. Back on Earth, Lancelot has infiltrated the Salisbury Down nuclear power plant, last seen in issue 1, where he takes out several aliens, making it safe for Tom and Guinevere to enter. They go to the cooling pool and Lancelot calls Elaine, who appears as a Lady of the Lake. Elaine transports the trio to Planet 10 just in time for the rest of the round table to land. As Arthur asks her about the Grail, they walk over Rise and spot Castle Le Fay. Next issue, War.
This is like a real, as are most of the issues, it feels like a real cool build-up for what's to come.
Yes.
You know, I mean, prelude to War, and the next issue is War. And, you know, it is time, I guess, to get to the meat of the story, because we are wrapping it up soon. But I don't feel like, as is the usual, I don't feel like I'm being let down by the build-up. I'm enjoying the heck out of it, and I'm getting a decent amount of action as it's going along. I have a couple of notes on it. The first one was the cover feels to me like it should be part of a two-part cover, almost. Yes. Like the backside of it should continue and have the other side of who's shooting at them or whatever. So yeah. But otherwise, yeah, it's a pretty cool cover.
Yeah, it looks like a piece of something. It does give you the idea of you're being thrown in the middle, which you kind of are in most of this.
Yeah, no, it definitely gives you the frenetic feeling that, you know, that there's a lot of danger going on for our heroes. And you know, I mean, all the laser blasts going across the cover, it's like, wow, and nobody got hit. Are they stormtroopers on the other side? I liked the whole. I guess, prelude to it, where they take out the world leaders. I was a little surprised. I don't know enough, again, and here I'm going to pick away at your Arthurian lore a little bit. Is it part of the lore that the Holy Grail could be melted into an armor? Like, is there, because I always kind of felt like it had to maintain its original form in order for it to have its properties.
Well, the Grail is itself malleable. Think of it this way. The Grail would appear to you and I differently, because your beliefs differ from my beliefs. So I would see it more, probably not exactly like the Celtic interpretation, which is the Black Cauldron, for you Disney files out there. But so it depends on each person's beliefs of how the Grail looks. Therefore, someone like Mordred could, with Morgan's help, transmute that into a set of armor. So I'm not that put off by it.
So I'm not really put off by it. I'm just questioning because I don't know. So based upon Grail lore, would it be that if Mordred stopped having use for it, it would go back to whatever form the observer saw it in?
Yes. So once he takes the armor off and puts it aside, most likely it would just revert into the chalice.
So if Modri took it off and left the room and walked away, and then I walked in, it would look like the one that Indiana Jones drank out of.
Yes. Yeah.
Because in my mind, that's what it looks like.
The cup of a carpenter, of course.
Yes. In fact, I need to buy one of those to put it into my display cabinet. The Indiana Jones version of the Holy Grail. What else did I have here? Oh, I enjoyed the whole Tristan having to bite his tongue and act like a femme fatale.
Yes.
I thought that was a cool play on things. What else did I have here? I got a kick out, not a kick at it, but I thought it was pretty cool the way they show Lancelot making his way through, you know, kind of demonstrating his warrior abilities.
Yeah, I mean, he is one of the greatest warriors of all time, and he's pissed off.
Yeah.
So he's not even saying anything. He's just mowing these aliens down.
Well, he's one of the greatest warriors, and he has been humiliated mm-hmm. by the Grail being taken from him. You know, his sense of honor demands that he takes care of this now.
Yes.
And I got it. You know, the artwork, as usual, is stellar. I liked the envisioning of Castle Lefay and what it would look like. Just, you know, basically, you know, mossy and moldy and just dingy and nasty. Yeah. You know, I like it. It looks formidable just to go to it. Nevertheless, what you're going to find inside.
Right. And it's just enormous, too. I mean, it really, you know, if you think about it, Morgan doesn't have an army. When she was on this planet, she had all these aliens serving her, but she was it. You know, she didn't have any onlookers or anything. So this is just a monument to her ego. It's just, I'm going to have something bigger and better than Camelot. Bang, here it is.
It's bigger. I don't know if it's better.
Well, in her mind.
And when she takes out the African leader, the fact that what takes him out is what appears to be the same stuff that's growing on her back is kind of a cool touch.
Yeah, it just eats him down to the bone. It is, ugh. And the U.S. president has a toupee, which is fun.
Yeah, that's kind of a cool thing, especially since he's been kind of shown to be a phony throughout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's more theatrics than reality. Although he, against a normal opposition, he shows himself to be, you know, quite capable with the firearm. You know, if Modred didn't have the healing ability from the Grail, you know, he was done.
Yeah, exactly. He was actually dead until the Grail brought him back.
And that's kind of a cool, another place to point out in the artwork where I think it's really cool, because you have four consecutive shots. We have the bullets going through him. Then you have the president blowing the smoke off his gun while Modred's on the ground, you know, basically dead. And then in the next shot, as the president's starting to walk away, Modred's eye opens up. And in the next shot, he's standing. And it's not unlike if you were a fan of professional wrestling in the last, whatever, 20, 30 years, The Undertaker, and the way he would kind of be unconscious on the mat and resurrect.
Yes. Just sit straight up and then look. And yeah, you know, match was nowhere near over at that point.
Yeah, and that's very well represented by that series of panels. I can never give enough kudos to the artwork in this book. It is not like the absolute best images that I've ever seen. You know, I still save that for like Neil Adams and John Romita and Jack Kirby and whatever. But the artwork is, you know, the renderings are excellent. And the storytelling and pacing throughout this has been absolutely spot on great. This entire run. Terry Austin is definitely a very good compliment to the pencils that we're getting here as well. I mean, Terry Austin is one of the all-time great inkers, period. So it certainly doesn't hurt to add somebody like that onto your group.
Right.
But everything about the artwork really stands out as excellent to me.
Oh, I agree. And, as usual, the writing is really up to snuff. You get everyone's story going on, and it's really well handled.
Yeah, and I mentioned the pacing and the artwork. The pacing and the story is just as impressive. You know, he's breaking things down with, somewhere along the line, Mike Barr sat down and said, okay, I'm going to go 12 issues. This is the story I'm going to tell. And he must have broken it down to what story, how much of the story he was going to tell in each issue. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a perfect balance, to be honest with you.
Yes. And here he is. You think, oh, issue 10, he's exhausted the bits of Arthurian lore he can bring in. And then Elaine shows up. And Elaine is right out of the original Legends. So to give you the Mort d'Arthur version, Elaine's father was having a tournament at his castle. And there were several Arthurian knights there. Lancelot wasn't originally supposed to be there, but he ended up showing up in disguise, as he did a lot. Because if you're going up in against Lancelot in a joust, you're just going to say, I give up, because I know I'm not going to win. But in this case, he was going up against Sir Bors, and Bors managed to wound him. So Elaine begs her father to let Lancelot recover there with them. And then we get the whole Florence Nightingale Back to the Future bit happening, where she falls in love with him. But because he is devoted to Guinevere, he can't be with her. He tells her this flat out, and she dies from the feeling of unrequited love. That's how much she loved him and couldn't have him. Now, in this, it's bar changes a little bit, in which, Merlin casts a spell on her where she becomes one with the water, which is how she can do all the fun water teleportation stuff she does in the story. But it's still the same basic idea. She loved Lancelot, she couldn't have him, and she was done after that. But he brings it back around, and they actually have a nice goodbye in it, where she says that she's now at peace. Lancelot's happy for her, and she does him whatever, the favor he asks, which is transport the three of them to Planet 10.
So now, remind me, the one that's holding Merlin captive, was she a Lady of the Lake also?
Yes, that's Nivaine.
She's the insane Lady of the Lake.
She is the nut job, yes. And as we'll see in your issue, boy, is she weird.
Well, we should rate this as our usual custom. And I'm going to go off the charts here and say A's all around. And I'm trying to decide, you know what? I'm going to say an A on the cover because it feels slightly incomplete.
Right.
And I'm going to say A plus on the artwork and the story. And the only reason the cover is not an A plus is because it feels like there should be another half to it. But otherwise, that would be an A plus as well.
Yeah, I'm right there with you on every single grade. These guys continue to knock it out of the park, and it is so nice when you have something as this consistently good for the entire series. Now, we haven't gotten to issue, we'll talk about issue 11, but we haven't gotten to issue 12 yet, so maybe it falls off a cliff, but don't bet on it.
I would put my money on them being able to land this baby successfully. But we'll see what we get, and we'll see where it is, because as has been our usual custom, I have not read beyond what we're covering. And I read these issues so long ago that I have nothing but a vague recollection of what went on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that said, I guess we're going to go on to issue 11, which is cover dated July of 1984 and has a cover price of $1.25. And sadly, I'm going to interrupt the description here to say you can probably still find it in a bin for somewhere not too much beyond that price.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a sad reflection on such a great series. We are, once again, written by Mike. But, well, actually, it says writers, co-creators, plotters, artist by Mike Barr and Brian Bolland. Embellisher, Terry Austin. Editor, Len Wein. Lettered by John Costanza. Colored by Tatiana Wood. And it's continuing the legends chronicled by Sir Thomas Malory. The cover shows Arthur, Guinevere, and Lancelot on the branches of a tree looking at an extremely large and sinister-looking insectoid creature. This issue's title is War. And what is it good for? Actually, that is not the title. The title is just War. And it's brought to us by the creative team that we just went through. The story opens with the World News headline declaring that Arthur has murdered the four slain government leaders and then fled the earth. It's being read by the wife and son of Sir Gawain. She is expressing faith in her husband, but the boy isn't so sure. So it's showing you that the propaganda is kind of getting to him a little bit. Cut to the UN offices where Ms. Lachlan, or Isolde, is reviewing the latest propaganda poster, which shows Arthur holding Excalibur to Uncle Sam's throat. She rejects it with a flourish and decides that she needs to be more proactive. She finds an imprint of the seal of Morgan Le Fay and knows that they've been played. So she sends a message to our heroes. Speaking of our heroes, we join them on the recently discovered 10th planet, camping in a cloaked tent, discussing the effects of World War III in the 23rd century and the task of society having to rebuild itself. Sir Tom receives Isolde's message warning of Matthew's teaming with Morgan Le Fay, but destroys the last portion where she transmits her love to Tristan. Meanwhile, Tristan and Guinevere are awakened by a humming. Guinevere posits that only they too can hear it because of their lack of Y chromosomes. Tristan is, of course, offended by this, and Guinevere tells her to shut her pie hole. I don't know if she uses those words, but pretty much says it. It seems the source of the humming is an approaching horde of aliens. Arthur puts out the call to arms, but Galahad, Guinevere, and Tristan advise that they are not sensing aggression, and they allow them to approach in peace, carrying two... I can't even read my own writing here. Palanquins?
Palanquins.
When Arthur goes to enter, he is beckoned to stop, and the females are indicated to use them, which Tristan does only grudgingly. They proceed into caves, where they ultimately come face to face with the enormous creature from the cover of our story. She wishes to speak with the leader, She wishes to speak to their leader and rejects Arthur in favor of Guinevere. She informs Guinevere that their world is called Chiron, which is, by the way, the name of a Greek centaur. And it was an ice world where their people lived peacefully, and she is their queen and birthed their race. That is, until Morgan Le Fay arrived. She did not care for the cold and changed it to a warm clime. When she required followers, she took the alien children and forced them to serve her. And for this, the queen wishes her dead and will help Arthur. Cut to the castle where Morgan and Modred are holed up. Modred is anxious to slay Arthur, and Morgan calls for patience, saying that the group will come to them because they are holding Merlin captive. And now, with our group ready to make an assault on the castle, as predicted by Morgan, Arthur and Lancelot are making plans, and Lancelot pleads to lead the way to retrieve the Holy Grail, but Arthur rejects that plan. Lancelot actually knocks Arthur out and advises the knights that they need to move forward, that Arthur is off praying. The assault team, consisting of Lancelot, Tom, Tristan, and Gawain, are smuggled in by the aliens. Once in the castle, they each separate and go about their business. Arthur, now awake, joins Galahad and Guinevere, and we have a reconciliation of sorts between the king and queen. And then they lead the alien army forward. Within the castle, Mordred and Morgan move to defend the castle. Morgan releases some of her demonic creatures, and Tristan engages an amorphous creature. Lancelot encounters Mordred and is his superior in swordplay. However, armored with the Holy Grail, Mordred cannot be injured and eventually manages to stab Lancelot, who drops to the ground. Cut back to Tristan's battle, where the strange creature that she's been battling wraps her up and reveals himself to be a mutated Owen, her former fiancé. To be concluded next issue. Oh my God. This is just so good.
It's the same thing. It builds and builds and builds, and you're not dissatisfied with it. It's just great the way it goes. And it's like, same thing. You know, I'm not reading ahead. So it's one, you know, it's I've got to the end of this. I can't read 12 yet. Calm down.
Exactly. But as soon as we're done recording, I can read 12.
Well, yes. Yes.
So I'm looking forward to that. I mean, I say that the two most, you know, let me back that up a little. When you're dealing with a story like this, the best stories that I can come up with are the ones where the opposition seems unable to be defeated. And you need to figure out how are they going to get by this. And as a reader or a viewer in a movie or whatever it might be, you feel like, you know, like it just, I can't figure out how they're going to do it. So that makes it all the more exciting to read it or to watch it. So now, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, because I don't know, I haven't read it yet, but you got to figure Arthur's going to have a final stand against Morgan Le Fay of some sort. Obviously, we have Tristan and Owen, which right now Owen looks unbeatable. And we have Lancelot against Mordred, and Mordred looks unbeatable. So it's just like, well, how is this going to end? How are they going to, you know, what deus ex machina is going to happen that's going to allow this to be resolved in a satisfactory way? And I've read many books in my life where this has been the kind of buildup. And then the conclusion happens and you're like, really? That's all? Yeah. That's what happened? I don't anticipate that happening because, again, I don't remember what happened, but I have read this and I don't remember being disappointed by it.
Right. Yeah, I'm the same way. I read this completely through a few years ago. And yeah, I was definitely not disappointed by the end, but yeah, this is one of those things where, like we were talking about when Mordred's memories came back and we see Merlin and Arthur laughing about how they're drowning children. We learned that, well, Morgan was an unreliable narrator too, because when she first told Matthew, before Mordred was reawakened, about how she got her alien servants, it was, I showed up on this planet and they were just so keen to serve me and everything. But now we find out, no, she took unhatched eggs and did something to them and turned them in that portion of the population into slaves. And yeah, I can understand why the queen wants her dead.
Yeah, really. Yeah, and you know what? That's a good point, because when we got that storyline where Mordred has his version of the facts and he presents them as having raped and killed and done horrible things, I was ready to write it off in my own headcanon as, well, that's his perspective. But now that you've pointed out that, well, Morgan did the same thing, and that's already been proven to be incorrect, that supports that it's beyond headcanon. It's kind of the way the story is being told.
Right.
So I can appreciate that I don't have to make up my own version of the facts, mm-hmm. that it's, you know, it's supported by the story. I got a kick out of the whole, you know, that the female leader of the insectoid race just assumes that the females are the leaders of the humanoid race. You know, that she doesn't have the same respect for the men because they are just the soldiers.
Right. They're the drones. You know, it's, and yes. she's seen evidence of this in Morgan. So it's like, okay, well, that female was the leader. So obviously these other females must be leaders.
The art again is excellent.
Yes. And one thing I really like is how Bolland distinguishes between Morgan's aliens and the aliens that are not changed. Because the ones that are not changed, they look peaceful. You know, their skin is smoother. They have these big wide eyes. It helps that their litters are made of wood and fabric and not, you know, limbs of other aliens, which was really disgusting. But it's obvious which, you know, which is the good race based on that.
The good aliens almost have like a bird-like look about them, whereas the aliens that have been co-opted are more lizard-looking.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, I like when Arthur's holding the egg and the one pops out and it looks like a baby bird coming out.
The rendering of Morgan's little monster creatures, again, just very cool. And Owen as a amorphous blob with eyes all over him just looks very threatening to begin with. And then you start adding the Owen face in there. Mm-hmm. Great ending to this issue. Oh, yeah.
And those facial expressions on that last splash is just great because Owen's looking super self-satisfied, and he's got a tendril around Tristan's neck, and she is, just completely panicked, you know, choking, wants to find out what, you know, how do I get out of this, but it's just, it's great.
Now, that tendril makes me think of the tendril that went around Krug's neck in Star Trek III. If you remember what I'm talking about.
Yep. And where he just...
Yeah, he just kind of crushed it with his hand. And. Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm picturing in my mind to make it more visceral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this goes how my brain works. The page before that, where we have Mordred and Lancelot fighting. Well, first of all, Lancelot cuts off a third of his head and then he gets immediately healed. But Mordred stabs Lancelot, and while it's not the same side of the body, it's the same area of the body that Lancelot gets stabbed in Excalibur when he's trying to purge himself from his love of Guinevere. So I don't know if that's on purpose or not, since this was a few years after Excalibur came out, but it's just one of the things I keyed in on.
Yeah. So cool.
And then we have Nivain. Nightmare fuel.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, for those of you that have not read this recently, we have Nivain, who normally is wearing, I'll call it a sun mask. Like, it's a mask of a beautiful woman's face with what look like sun rays coming off of it. And she's in, I would say, a negligee, pink negligee with nothing else. great long red hair. She's dancing around Merlin. Then she decides to take the mask off, and her entire face is nothing but a huge mouth. No eyes, no nose.
With a giant mop of hair.
Yes.
But, you know, like, I guess nice hair. And then the venom tongue.
Mm-hmm. And, ooh.
Yeah, you don't want to be kissing there.
You don't look at her head, and the body is like he was drawing something for Penthouse. You know, super sexy and everything, but then he had to do that with her face.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I should have seen it coming, but I was a little surprised, thrown off, whatever you want to call it, by Lancelot not betraying Arthur, but overtaking him and not listening to his orders. That actually, when that happened, I was like, oh, look at that.
Yeah.
You know, like, I didn't expect it.
Yeah, it's a Doc Holliday moment.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I've seen it.
Yeah.
It's not an original.
No.
To those moments when they occur, and again, I've seen it in many TV shows, movies, comic books, but the key to it is to have it be unexpected, because the person who's getting cold cocked doesn't expect it, and they need you as the reader to be in that guy's shoes when it happens.
Yes,
and I think they did that effectively here.
Yeah, the writing and the art team up terrific there, and yeah, it's... Oh, they're having this nice chat, and Lancelot, and it's shown in shadow, but Lancelot's got his head down like, yes, I accept, and then bang! Just.
But part of that, I think, is due to the fact that Lancelot has already shown a sadness or remorse, whatever you want to call it, for his already betraying Arthur with Guinevere.
Yes.
So you think he's been... at the point where he's, you know, so much wanting Arthur's approval to make up for what he did, that he would never do what he does here.
Right. Yes.
But that all said, when Arthur wakes up and comes out, it doesn't seem like he carries a great deal of resentment with him. It seems like he understands Lancelot's motives there and accepts them, unlike when he was betrayed with the Guinevere thing.
Right, yeah. And what Arthur says later when he's talking to Guinevere is, hey, we're probably all going to die here. We can't have any regrets. And he completely makes up with Guinevere. So that it looks like that's what he's trying to do here with Lancelot. And Lancelot's, you're my best friend. I'm not letting you go into the castle.
Well, I don't even think it's so much that he wasn't going to let Arthur go in. I think it was that he felt he had to go in. I think he was honor bound to go in because he needed to recover the Grail.
True. Yes.
Which is ultimately, I guess, where that story is going, that he's facing off against Modred, who has the Grail. Now, right now, it's looking darkest before the dawn, but I got to think that when this story is over, Lancelot's going to be alive and that Grail will have been recovered.
We shall see. Stay tuned, true believers.
So, I guess we're going to rate this again. And... the only thing that would makes me even wonder about giving an A+ to the cover is that queen insect thing is so gross looking. but I think that's exactly the purpose. I think it is an A+. It's not something that I'm it's not something that I'm going to want to have a copy to frame and hang up anywhere, but I just think it's really so well done and so potentially deceptive, making you think that the queen is, you know, evil and that they're on the defensive there when it's just the opposite. So it's you know, throwing you a curveball. And I just think it's so well drawn and just really great. The interior art, the interior art in the story, I'm just, you know, I feel like I'm just a broken record, but A+, A+.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. Straight A+ with it. But yeah, because we've been reading this series for 10 issues by this point, you get to this, and it's like, you look at the cover, and it gets you. It's like, oh, they already had enough to deal with. Now this? and it really throws you off, but it makes, but it's another thing where it makes you want to read the story more. So yeah, definitely A pluses across the board.
You know, we talk about like the hero's journey, which we've talked about since the beginning, and in its own way, it's okay. Now they're on Endor and the Ewoks are on their side and going to help them against the evil empire. So, you know, there's a lot going on, and I just look forward to issue 12. Gene, do you think you can make time in your busy schedule to cover issue 12 with me?
I don't know. yeah, we're definitely going to be doing that.
All right, well, I'm going to look forward to that, and I hope you listeners, if you can give us some feedback, the best way to do it is through Facebook. You can put it on. The best thing is probably to go to the Facebook Back to the Bins page. If you're not a member of that group, please join it. And then, you know, each week I put a post up for that week's episode, and in the comments, you know, let us know what you think. If you like it, if you don't like it, there's something you think we missed, let us know. That's probably the easiest way to make your thoughts known. That, and to go to whatever podcatcher you use and give us 5 stars.
Yes. Even if you don't like it, give it 5 stars just to stick it to us, you know, just
stick it to the man.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks again, Gene, for coming on. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back next week. Bye bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.